Deva Sudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. A reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 7, Chapter 10, Prahlad, the Best Among Exalted Devotees, Text 4. Nanyata te kila guru, gatita karunatmana, yastva aishisha asaste, nasa bhijja savaivani, Nanyata te kila guru, gatita karunatmana, yasta eshisha ashaste, nasa pritcha savaivani, nanyata te kila guru, Gatita karunatmana yasta eshisha ashaste nasa pritcha savaivanik nanyata te kila guru gatita karunatmana Yasta ashisha asaste Nasa bhijja savaivanik Ladies? Na, not, anyata, otherwise, t, day of you. Akila Guru, O supreme instructor of the entire creation. Gatita, such a thing can happen. Karuna Atmana, the supreme person who is extremely kind to his devotees. Ya, any person who, te, from you, ashisha, material benefits, ashaste, desires in exchange for serving you. Na, not, sa, such a person, mrija, a servitor, sa, such a person, vai, indeed, vanik, a merchant who wants to get material profit from his business. Translation. Otherwise, O my Lord, O supreme instructor of the entire world, you are so kind to your devotee that you could not induce him to do something unbeneficial for him. On the other hand, one who desires some material benefit in exchange for devotional service cannot be your pure devotee. Indeed, he is no better than a merchant who wants profit in exchange for service. Please repeat. Otherwise, O my Lord, O supreme instructor of the entire world, you are so kind to your devotee that you could not induce him to do something unbeneficial for him. On the other hand, one who desires some material benefit in exchange for devotional service cannot be your pure devotee. Indeed, he is no better than a merchant who wants profit in exchange for service. Purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada Ki. It is sometimes found that one comes to a devotee or a temple of the Lord just to get some material benefit. Such a person is described here as a mercantile man. Bhagavad Gita speaks of artho jignashur artarti. The word arta refers to one who is physically distressed, and artarti refers to one in need of money. Such persons are forced to approach the Supreme Personality of Godhead for mitigation of their distress or to get some money by the benediction of the Lord. They have been described as Sukriti, pious, because in their distress or need for money, they have approached the Supreme Lord. Unless one is pious, one cannot approach the Supreme Personality of Godhead. However, although a pious man may receive some material benefit, one who is concerned with material benefits cannot be a pure devotee. When a pure devotee receives material opulences, this is not because of his pious activity, but for the service of the Lord. When one engages in devotional service, one is automatically pious. Therefore, a pure devotee is anya bilasita sunyam. He has no desire for material profit, nor does the Lord induce him to try to profit materially. When a devotee needs something, the Supreme Personality of Godhead supplies it. Yoga shemam vaham yaham. Sometimes materialists go to a temple to offer flowers and fruit to the Lord because they have learned from Bhagavad Gita that if a devotee offers some flowers and fruits, the Lord accepts them. In Bhagavad Gita 9:26, the Lord says, Patram pushpam palam toyam. If one offers me with love and devotion a leaf, a flower, fruit, or water, I will accept it. Thus a man with a mercantile mentality thinks that if he can get some material benefit, like a large amount of money, simply by offering a little fruit and flower, this is good business. Such persons are not accepted as pure devotees. Because their desires are not purified, they are still mercantile men, even though they go to temples to make a show of being devotees. Sarvabhati vinir muktam tat paratvena nirmalam. Only when one is fully freed from material desires can he be purified, and only in that purified state can one serve the Lord. Rishikena rishikesha sevanam bhakti uchate. This is the pure devotional platform. Translation again. Otherwise, O my Lord, O Supreme Instructor of the entire world, you are so kind to your devotee that you could not induce him to do something unbeneficial for him. On the other hand, one who desires some material benefit in exchange for devotional service cannot be your pure devotee. Indeed, he is no better than a merchant who wants profit in exchange for service. Om Majanayatam Randashaganjana Shalakaya Chakshur Mitamyena Tasmaya Sri Guravena Mahashi Titanya Manobishtam Stabitamyena Buddhale Swayavagadamayam Dadati Swabadantikam. Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nichananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Shivasati Gaura Bhaktavrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Whenever I'm reading this section of the Bhagavatam, this pastime, or thinking about it, which unfortunately maybe isn't as often as I should be, but I can never... Well, a couple of thoughts. One thought that comes to mind is that, which I suppose is a fairly obvious thought, that, of course, you know, Hiranyakashipu was a fantastic philosopher, but... he had different motives for understanding philosophy. But anyway, the thought that comes to mind is he wasn't reading Srila Prabhupada's purports, you know. Because when you read Srila Prabhupada's purports, how could you do what a Hiranyakashipu did? And then the second part, which is connected, that comes to mind, is that the very last thing that Hiranyakashipu... Oh, sorry. Acha. Okay. So Hiranyakashipu obviously wasn't reading Prabhupada's purports, or else he wouldn't have done what he did. And then the second part of that is, and then connected to that, the thought that always comes to mind is effectively the last words that Hiranyakashipu uttered. And of course, if we can imagine, we know the context that he uttered those words was that Lord Nrisimhadev had just burst out of the pillar. And of course, you know, I'm sure that most of us, if not all of us, have been to Mayapur. And there, of course, we have the deity of Lord Nrisimhadev at that very moment bursting out of the pillar. Actually, and I should try and control my mind because I'm giving class, but, you know, as thoughts pop in, I'm thinking of things. But currently there's a little bit of a debate, which I won't go into, but I'll just mention a little bit of a debate that, you know, since Lord Nrisimhadev was installed in Mayapur in 1984, only, as far as I know, only those wearing saffron cloth can actually worship him as pujaris. I think on festival days, different devotees can participate a little bit, but in general, as the full-time pujaris, they have to wear saffron cloth. This apparently came from some devotees who said this was... Of course, you know, our understanding is that Kiba Vipra Kiba Nasi Sudakena Nai Krishna Tattva Veta Se Guru Hai, that actually the color of the cloth is not really very important, but it's our consciousness and our level of advancement in Krishna consciousness. So, but anyway, that's been the standard in Mayapur since 84. And now some devotees are raising it as an issue, and they're saying, is this really, you know, are we actually following Srila Prabhupada's example by having these kind of things in place? But the reason that I mention it now in the class is that when I'm in Mayapur, and you know, Mangal Arati in Mayapur, when the Sringa Puja takes place, I'm sure many of you have been there, it's a pretty far out thing if you can manage to get a place where you can actually see Lord Nrisimhadev, you know. And of course, if you do manage to get a place where you can see Lord Nrisimhadev before the doors have opened, you know, you need to get super glue and glue the super glue to your feet to stick you to that position. Otherwise, you'll get some enthusiastic, generally kind of local Indian personalities who will mercifully push you out of the way. But anyway, when the doors open, if you do get to take darshan on Lord Nrisimhadev, I mean, it is an amazing thing. And Lord Nrisimhadev, he's in that Ugra Nrisimha, that fearsome Nrisimha. I think it's Ugra Stanhu Nrisimha, which is what the ninth or the most fearsome of all the nine different forms of Lord Nrisimhadev. So my thought always is that I would be scared to be on the altar offering puja. That's just my reaction. So regardless of the color of the cloth that I'm wearing, I don't have so much interest in that particular debate that is taking place. But anyway. Yeah, exactly. The last thing I want is that they open the floodgates for everybody and then you get asked to offer arati. So here we have now Ugra Stanu Nrisimha, Lord Nrisimhadev, and just so fearsome in the description of his nails and his tongue and his eyes. And, you know, I mean, I don't know about you, ears, yeah. But I don't know about all of you, but, you know, even if you're walking down the street in the nighttime and it's dark and, you know, you hear an unusual noise, or you hear someone walking behind you, or you hear a dog bark, it's kind of like, ooh. So can you imagine facing Lord Nrisimhadev in that particular form? So that was the position of Hiranyakashipu, that was what he was facing. And yet the very last thing that he said, the last words that he uttered were, Prayena Meyam Hari Noru Mayena. And roughly translated into kind of colloquial English, what he actually said to Lord Nrisimhadev, and you see that picture, that BTG or that BBT picture you see with Hiranyakashipu with his puny little shield, you know, trying to protect against Lord Nrisimhadev. And also in that pastime, as far as I remember, well, not so much the pastime, but the detail that I think Lord Nrisimhadev is something like 20 times the size of Hiranyakashipu. Anyway, he was significantly larger than Hiranyakashipu. So here you have this fearsome personality. He says, Prayena Meyam Hari Noru Mayena. And roughly translated, as I understand, I think that Prabhu is looking at it on his iPad there. But the way I was going to translate... Yeah. And he translates it... Oh, sorry. As I say, the rough translation is, Come on, Vishnu. Give me your best shot. Let's see what you're made of. Let's see what you've got. You know? And then, of course, maybe 3.5 seconds later, he's lying on Lord Nrisimhadev's lap with his entrails all over the place. So anyway, that thought always comes to mind in this particular pastime, that the arrogance that we can, and that's the point, that we all can... achieve, if that's the right word, it's probably the wrong word, but the arrogance, there's no difference between any living entity and Hiranyakashipu, other than he's really developed his material desires to a very perfect, if you like, degree. But we all have the potential to do exactly the same. So here, Prahlad Maharaj, it's being expressed how Krishna is so kind to his devotees that you could not induce them to do something that's unbeneficial for them. So Krishna, he doesn't want us to be in this suffering condition. We're all, as we know, living in this material world, and as our bodies get older, it doesn't really matter when our body's getting older, but certainly as our body's getting older, there's just so much suffering involved, and suffering on all the different platforms of the body, the mind, etc. But Krishna, he doesn't want us to actually, he doesn't want us to be in that situation. Earlier in this particular part of the pastime, Prahlad Maharaj says things, when Lord Nrisimhadeva is offering him benedictions, Prahlad Maharaj says things like, don't tempt me with those benedictions like that. And then he says, I'm afraid of them. I'm afraid of those material benedictions. And Prabhupada also responded something similar one time when devotees asked him. I think that the question they more or less asked him was, you know, how are you not affected by Maya? How do you, you know, how are you sort of, in one sense, free from Maya? And Prabhupada's response was that I have a healthy respect or a healthy fear of Maya like that. So Prahlad was saying exactly the same thing, that don't tempt me with these material desires. I'm afraid of them. And one of the reasons that he's afraid of them is that these material desires, they're residing in the heart, the core of the heart of all living entities. That's where these material desires. And our process of devotional service of Bhakti Yoga, as you know, is to uproot those desires and to remove them by the root for good. Not that we tempt fate and indulge in any way in those material desires. And also in this particular chapter, or the previous chapter maybe, Lord Nrisimhadeva is getting on Lord Brahma's case effectively, and he tells him, you know, that you shouldn't be offering benedictions to the Asuras. You shouldn't be doing this because you're indulging them and it's not good for them. So in that same way here, we're seeing that, or in this translation, that Krishna never does anything. He never does anything to induce devotees to do something that's unbeneficial for them. However, he does everything, absolutely everything he can, to attract us away from the material world, to attract us away from our suffering. That's Krishna's whole agenda, to do that. And of course, we, you know, that's fairly obvious in all the unlimited incarnations of Krishna, and they're all designed in one way or another to actually attract us out of the material world. So then, on the other hand, one who desires some material benefit in exchange for devotional service cannot be your pure devotee. And then indeed, he's no better than a merchant. It's an interesting sentence. He's no better than a merchant who wants profit in exchange for service. Of course, every merchant wants profit in exchange for the business that they do. Otherwise, they won't be in business for very long. But still, the analogy with performing devotional service, we shouldn't want anything in return. Now, of course, that's a very it's a very, very high platform of not wanting anything in return. And ISKCON, as we go forward in some of the, one of the discussions we're having in some of the meetings that we're having here, is about looking after devotees. But on one side, we have to care for devotees. But so, and Krishna consciousness is like that in so many situations. There's so many juxtapositions, or depending on what service you're doing or what your role is in the society, you have a particular function. So on one level, as individual devotees, we should have no desire for material profit, not least because it's so corrosive for our devotional life. That wonderful verse, 330, is it 330 in Bhagavad Gita? Mai sarvani karmani sanyasyatma chetasa nirashir nirmamo bhutva yujasa vigatashvara, where, you know, Krishna's telling Arjuna, as you read it, it's quite amazing, you know. You must do your service, you must do your duty, actually, you must do your duty, so we all have a duty to perform, but you must do it with free from any desire for fame, any desire for recognition, any desire for profit, any desire for proprietorship over absolutely anything. So you must do it without any of those desires or looking for something in return. But then the last line is completely free from lethargy. So not only must you not want any of those things, but then you must do your duty, do your service, super enthusiastic like that. So as individual devotees, that's one of the roles, that's one of the things that we have to guard against, allowing any desire to creep in for our own personal profit or our own personal benefit. But then, as a devotee, and in organizing a society like a society of devotees like ISKCON, there's also a responsibility on all of us to make sure that devotees are looked after nicely and taken care of. So anyway, Krishna consciousness is full of those kind of... I'm reminded of that story. I think it was when Shutakirti Prabhu was Srila Prabhupada's servant, and they were in Switzerland. I think they were in Switzerland. I think it was Switzerland they were in. I think it's sketchy on these stories. They all tend to merge a little bit, but I'll give the essence of it. And they had been with the... Prabhupada had cooked a feast, I think, the day before, but I think it was probably just for the two of them. I don't think it was a feast because there was no temple there as such. But anyway, he cooked a feast, and the gist of it was that there was sweet rice left over. And Prabhupada was traveling, the next day they were traveling on to another place, wherever it was, and I think at that place they were going to a temple where there would be devotees. So there was this sweet rice left over, and as you know, if you've got a piece of burfi left over, it's kind of relatively convenient to carry it with you. But, you know, sweet rice is like, you know, when you're in a temple and you're leaving and the devotees are being really, really kind and really, really thoughtful and really, really helpful, and they want to give you some prasadam to take away with you. And you kind of say, oh, well, that's very kind, thank you, thank you. And then, you know, when you get to the airport or when you get some situation where you're about to, where you can take the prasadam, you know, you notice that they've given you this, like, soup, you know. Soup is, like, leaked out of the thing. And rather than being able to honor the prasadam and enjoy the prasadam, it becomes a whole trip, you know, and it's gone onto your clean clothes in your bag, you know. It's like, oh, my God, what am I going to... And, you know, next thing is this big thing taking place on the floor of the airport, you know, and all these other people looking at you as if you're some kind of, like, a lunatic, you know. Anyway, so Prabhupada had this sweet rice, and, you know, this sweet rice stuff, and Shudakirti asked Prabhupada, what should we do with the sweet rice, you know, i.e., I think he was asking in the mood of, you know, I'm going to throw the sweet rice away because what are we going to do with the sweet rice, you know? And Prabhupada says, no, we should bring that with us. And Shudakirti was saying, well, we've nothing, how do we... And Prabhupada says, use the bathroom loto, or use a bathroom loto like that. And Shudakirti says, use a bathroom, put prasadam into a bathroom loto like that. So all these kind of, you know, situations that you get from time to time in Krishna consciousness, that, of course, Prabhupada's point was that the higher principle is to save the prasadam and to bring it on to the next place. Of course, I think he indicated to Shudakirti that he should, you know, properly clean the bathroom loto before putting the sweet rice into it. Anyway, so, on the other hand, one who desires some material benefit in exchange for devotional service cannot be your pure devotee. And then in the purport, Prabhupada explaining, he's quoting the verse about the four different types of people that come to Krishna consciousness. Like that. But this point about not wanting something for ourselves in relation to Krishna, in relation to devotional service, that it doesn't become a business transaction or a deal. As I say, it's so important because it will just continue our journey in the material world. We also will tend to, and is often the case, and something that we have to guard against, that particularly as devotees, because if we're engaging in devotional service but not properly engaging, and of course Prabhupada gives the example of the boat and the anchor in, and you know you're rowing and you're rowing and you're not making much progress, that we can become critical of the process of Krishna consciousness. We can become critical of Krishna. Many, many people, as you know, in the material world, particularly people who are more familiar with Christian tradition, that they will blame God. A lot of the atheists, one of their arguments is, how can you have a God that's so punishable and is inflicting pain, etc., etc., on people? What kind of God is that? Why would I want to worship that God? Why would I want to associate with that God? Why would I want to be with that God like that? So there's that verse in the fourth canto of the Bhagavatam, Navai Swa Paksho Swa Vipaksha Eva Cha, that explains it so nicely, and for devotees, that we have to, realize, hold on to these concepts because they're so important. That Krishna's neutral in the whole arrangement. Krishna's completely neutral. Samoham Sarvabhuteshu, Krishna's not siding with anybody, but we've chosen to come to the material world, completely our choice. And as soon as we come to the material world, as I say, Krishna's constantly sending, or he's coming himself in the form of incarnations, or he's sending his representatives, or as we are now. Of course, we're all sitting here, we're all devotees, we all know this, and we all are trying to engage nicely in the process of Krishna consciousness. But we have all access to all this knowledge, all this information, there's access to engage in so much service. But Navai Swa Paksho, that Krishna, because we've chosen to come to the material world, Krishna comes here in the form of time. He's coming here in the form of time. But the point is that that role of Krishna in the form of time is completely neutral. It's a completely neutral role. But the suffering and the reactions that we receive are a result of the activities that we engage in as a result of coming to the material world and being a victim, if you like, a victim of time. So it's completely our choice and completely our fault. And this is what happens when we come to the material world. Of course, initially, this is talking about people who have some concept of devotional service, but that we want some benefit from it. We're always looking to satisfy our senses and to have profit, etc. And it's a selfish engagement. So all the more that when we actually do take to the process of Krishna consciousness, the process of devotional service, that it really makes no logical sense to still want some benefit while we're engaging in that process. We understand logically and philosophically why we engage in devotional service. So why then, when we actually perform devotional service, would we still want to hold ourselves back? It's kind of almost like a torture that we know what we should be doing. It makes complete, perfect sense to us what we should be doing. But then we do it in a half-hearted way, and we're wanting some material benefit as a result, and that just holds us completely back from making progress on the devotional path. So, again, and I don't want to be controversial, I will very much try not to be, but I think it's relevant. There's one story, actually. I'll just introduce what I'm going to say by just giving one little pastime, Srila Prabhupada, that one devotee told me, who personally was involved in the pastime. And that was, this pastime took place in Mayapur, and Srila Prabhupada was in his room in Mayapur in the Lotus building. And this devotee, using his Western intelligence, as Prabhupada said, you Europeans and Americans, or he probably said you Americans and Europeans, right? He didn't say Europeans first, yeah, I'm sure. I'm very sorry. Americans and Europeans. Of course, you know, I think Prabhupada was just being kind to you Americans, because he obviously should have said Europeans first, you know, because, hey, you know, you're all Europeans. I was on a little Japa walk this morning, and I really felt at home. I saw a Catherine Ireland fabrics at the back here, and I saw a John Reardon plumbing. I think, hey, John Reardon, Catherine Ireland, you know, hey, you know. So anyway, you're all Europeans. So Prabhupada says, yes, using the intelligence of the Americans and the Europeans. And so this devotee, he knew Prabhupada was in his room, and he decided he was going to camp outside on the balcony until Prabhupada came out. He, you know, using his intelligence, he knew that Prabhupada was going to come out of that room at some point in time. Whether it was in an hour or 10 hours or 24 hours, Prabhupada was going to come out of the room. So he sat outside, and eventually Prabhupada came out. And Prabhupada actually didn't say anything to him, but then Prabhupada got up and he was walking along the veranda. So this devotee walked alongside him, or just behind him, hoping that he would get some exchange with Prabhupada and get some mercy like that, etc. And after a few rooms along the Lotus building, Prabhupada stopped. And he looked at the he looked into the room that he had stopped at. He looked like that, into the room like that, with sort of somewhat piercing eyes or searing eyes like that. And then he looked back at the devotee, and he didn't say anything, but he was indicating that. And then the devotee could hear, he heard there was a little noise in the room, and someone had left the fan on. And then Prabhupada said, what's this? You know, there is nobody in that room, and fan is going. You know. So then the devotee hadn't got the key, but somehow the window was open or something. He managed to get his hand through the lats or whatever it was like this, you know, and he eventually got it, and he turned the fan off. It's interesting, I'm sure you all remember as well. I certainly remember when I first came to Krishna consciousness. I think it was my very, very first night that I stayed in the temple. And you know that experience that, you know, you've never been up at 2 o'clock in the morning or 2:30 in the morning in your life. You've stayed up that late, but you've never actually gone to bed and got up at that time, you know, unless I was breaking into houses or something. No, I wasn't doing that. but first night in the temple, up at, I think it was 2:30, something like really early, you know, you're all disorientated, you're up, next thing you're in a bathroom with another 5, 6, 7, you know, young men or whatever it is, and, you know, and you're brushing your teeth and you're still asleep and the whole thing. And, of course, I switched the tap on, you know, and you put your toothbrush under the tap and then you're brushing your teeth like this, you know. And then the devotee beside me looks around, looks across me and says, "Prabhu, you're wasting Krishna's energy. Turn that tap off." You know? So that was a whole culture that we came up in, and it actually came from Prabhupada, that we shouldn't waste Krishna's energy. And ironically enough, it's amazing, in you spin forward to 2013, the whole issue with the environment and saving energy. Even the, it's funny, it says here, indeed he is no better than a merchant who wants profit. Every merchant, of course, wants profit. But even now, because of the whole environmental situation in the world, even the electricity companies are sending you letters to save energy. Even though they're obviously making profit from you using energy, they're sending you out, you know, circulars saying, you know, get this get your roof insulated, get this done, get that done to save energy like that. So there we go. Prabhupada, this was in the 70s, and Prabhupada is the foremost environmentalist, and he's telling this devotee to do this. So the devotee does that. He switches the fan off. The next day in class, Prabhupada is, you know, talking on the verse, and this devotee is sitting in the class, and within 5 minutes into Prabhupada talking, he starts talking about the incident yesterday when the fan was left on in the room. So not only was it just something Prabhupada noticed when he was walking past the room, it was something that he wanted to make a point about saving Krishna's energy and not wasting, etc. So Prabhupada explained the situation, a fan was left on in a room that there was nobody in, and then he looked at the devotee who was sitting in the first row, second row, third row, whatever was the class, and he said, "And he's the rascal who, you know." And of course, the devotee had absolutely nothing to do with it, other than the fact that maybe he should have walked along and checked all the rooms to see if there was fans on, but it was nothing to do with him in terms of leaving the fan on. So in front of the whole assembly of devotees, you know, this devotee, Prabhupada, come on. You know, I'm sure you've had that experience when you're blamed of something in the wrong. So that was that. So later that day or the next day, I can't remember, it was later that day or the next day, Srila Prabhupada, this devotee got the opportunity, he was with Prabhupada again. And of course, as we do, you know, as we do, we tend to be defensive. That's one of these, you know, animalistic tendencies, we tend to be defensive. So this devotee wanted to set the record straight, you know, with Prabhupada. So he was explaining to Prabhupada that actually it was nothing to do with him, etc., etc., etc. But Prabhupada was very, very kind, and this is what Prabhupada said to him in response. He said, "Oh, that's okay. I think he even said, I'm sorry." You know, he said, "That's okay. You don't have to worry about that, and now I understand." He said, "One time, I was in class, and my Guru Maharaj, he was giving the class, and I was sitting in the class listening to the class. And he said, and the person sitting beside me asked me a question or tried to engage me in conversation." You know how that is, Prabhu? You're sitting in class, you know, and the person beside you, next thing, starts talking to you, and you don't want to be rude, but at the same time, you're going, "Shut up, leave me alone." But, you know, but you don't want to do that. So Prabhupada, being polite, didn't want to do that. So he was kind of listening to this person. But then Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj chastised... Oh, okay, thank you. He turned, just turned to listen. And Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, that's what Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj saw. And Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj chastised Prabhupada. So Prabhupada was kind of chastised in the wrong, so to speak. And of course, on the transcendental platform, there's no question of being in the wrong. But it was so nice that Prabhupada was actually sharing with that devotee, because he had kind of done the same to that devotee. He was sharing that experience of his in the Bhagavatam class. But the reason that I brought that subject up of the fan and saving Krishna's energy is just related to what we're reading in the verse today about this, because in one sense, saving Krishna, that's a more subtle thing that we have to be careful about. This is more gross, that we're actually looking for some benefit from our devotional service. And when I read this morning, this verse, actually I read it yesterday, I didn't just read it this morning, I read it yesterday too. When I read it, the pastime that immediately came to my mind was the pastime in the Chaitanya Charitamrita of Gopinath Patanayaka. And I'm sure you're reasonably familiar, I'm sure some are very familiar with that particular pastime. And reading that pastime just, you know, it still really blows my mind, you know, reading that pastime and how Lord Chaitanya dealt with that particular situation. As we know, Gopinath Patanayaka, he was the brother of Ramananda Roy. He was part of the Roy family. So these are wonderful devotees. And, you know, he was more or less, I mean, you know, more or less, I won't get into all the detail, it would take a long time to, but more or less he was accused in the wrong. The king's son, King Prataparuja's son, he had an agenda against Gopinath Patanayaka, and he more or less not just accused him in the wrong, because there may have been some discrepancy, but then he tried to make out, the discrepancy, by the way, was a discrepancy of money, etc., or it was 200,000 kahanas of conch shells, I think, was the discrepancy. So whether that discrepancy, so it was effectively a monetary discrepancy, whether the discrepancy itself was particularly accurate, then he tried to imply that Gopinath Patanayaka was stealing the money from the king, because Gopinath was like a tax collector, so he was saying that he's collecting all these taxes, but he's not handing it all over to the king or to the government. So that was bad enough, but then he tried to imply he's using it for sense gratification and to go and visit dancing girls and, you know, and basically having a good time, you know. And Gopinath, of course, was really upset about this. And it's interesting, you know, he even offered to rectify whatever discrepancy that the king, the prince, figured was there. And he said he could pay him with his horses. He had some horses, and he said he could make the payment by giving the government or the king, the prince, the horses like that. So the prince said, okay, we'll examine these horses. And the prince examined them, and he completely undervalued them. And like Gopinath Patanayaka, he knew that he had completely undervalued them. They were worth, I don't know, double, triple, quadruple what the prince was actually valuing them at. And then he was really getting annoyed. He got annoyed to the point that the prince, the king's son, he apparently had a twitch, some kind of, you know. Oh, gosh, that puts another thought in my mind, twitching, actually, you know. Anyway, I know I definitely won't go down that road, actually. But anyway, he had a twitch. This prince had a twitch, you know. And Gopinath was so frustrated that he knew he had wrongly accused him, you know. Now he's undervaluing his horses to repay the debt, etc. That he says, Gopinath then says in kind of anger, these horses are worth a lot more. And one reason they're worth a lot more is, unlike you, they don't have a twitch. So he's really getting kind of frustrated. Anyway, the net result is the prince is in charge of this aspect of running the government. The net result is the prince decides that Gopinath Patanayaka has to go on the changa. You know, and I'm not going to develop this, but I'm just going to put it out there as a kind of a thought. It's interesting when you think that Lord Chaitanya came, and he was actually, as well as being the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and et cetera, he was a great social reformer in terms of, again, Kiva Vipra Kiva Nasi, Sudra Kenanai, Ekrishantavetase Guru Hai, and the whole thing about the untouchables, and the way he freaked out all the smarter Brahmins because, you know, he wanted everybody on an equal platform engaging in devotional service, etc. So in that context, Lord Chaitanya was a great social reformer. But it's interesting, isn't it? You read about the changa. You know, I grew up on, you know, Wild West movies when the white man was, you know, when they were fairly established in New York and Boston, but they were still trying to conquer the Wild West, you know, L.A., San Francisco. So those cowboy movies, I mean, I don't know, I grew up on them as a kid, you know. And, you know, one of the things that they had in the cowboy movies was when someone did something wrong, and they were adjudged to have done something wrong, they would get hung. That was how they dealt with it, you know. Maybe they even still do that in some parts of America, I don't know, you know. Maybe the European influence hasn't still come all the way to America, you know, death penalty and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, so the cowboy, they would hang them like that. And that was a fairly brutal thing, you know, put a rope around someone's neck and they pull the trapdoor and bang, they go down, they're killed. But when you read about the changa, I mean, that's a step above the hanging scenario. You know, I think it's a similar arrangement. They pull a trapdoor, but when the trapdoor gets pulled, the good news is you don't get hung. So that's the good news. But what the bad news is, you fall through the trapdoor onto a platform of, as it's described, solid. They're stationary solid. They don't move. You know, sharp swords. So you and the net result is that you die, you know. So you just fall, whoosh, and you just get sliced and diced, as we say, as they probably say in the streets of East LA, right? Sliced and diced. So it's interesting. Lord Chaitanya was a great social reformer, but he wasn't reforming against the Changha. Anyway, it's just a thought to go. There's other things that were happening in West Bengal at Lord Chaitanya's time that you could argue were bigger social issues than the issue of the untouchables. Anyway, that's just, as I say, a thought that I just put out there. But so the Changha. So Gopinath Patanayaka is coming from a family of, you know, exalted Vaishnavas. He's been wrongly accused, etc., and it's being exaggerated, and he's trying to find a solution, and the solution's not being accepted. And the devotees naturally go to Lord Chaitanya. That's where they go. They go, my Lord, you know, Gopinath Patanayaka, he's been put on the Changha. You know, please come and sort this situation out. You know, Lord Chaitanya at that time, of course, you know, in Jagannath Puri, he's completely absorbed in the holy names, you know, day and night. This is Lord Chaitanya in these incredible pastimes, absorbed in the holy name. And in essence, he says that he doesn't really want to be bothered with this kind of stuff. He's a sannyasi. It's not really any of his business. But the devotees are fairly insistent, and they ask Lord Chaitanya to rectify the situation. And Lord Chaitanya, and I actually wrote these out, actually, because I didn't want to bring my computer to class, and I just wanted to get the quotes correctly. These are some of Lord Chaitanya's responses to this situation. So, a wonderful exalted devotee who's been wrongly put into this situation. So Lord Chaitanya asked, he said, well, why is Gopinath Patanayaka being put on the Changha? And Lord Chaitanya says, he's told, because the king's son says that he hasn't paid he's kept back some of the money from the taxes, etc., the kahanas of conch shells. And Lord Chaitanya says, if Gopinath Patanayaka does not want to pay the king's money that is due, how is the king at fault? So that's Lord Chaitanya's reaction. And as I say, Gopinath Patanayaka is part of the Roy family. If Gopinath Patanayaka does not want to pay the king's money that's due, how is the king at fault? Then it goes on, and these are all quotes, this is all quoting Lord Chaitanya speaking. The revenue of the government is more sacred than the property of a Brahmin. The revenue of, this is you know, Lord Chaitanya speaking. The revenue of the government is more sacred than the property of a Brahmin. We know how Shastra talks about the property of a Brahmin, etc., being, you know, you shouldn't usurp it and you shouldn't misuse it, etc. But the revenue of the government is more important. Again, those juxtapositions when we think about, I can remember, you know, years ago, we had one of our temples was very, very close to this park. The park is called St. Anne's Park, and it's a beautiful park. It's hundreds of acres, and one section of it, they have a rose garden, and it's an absolutely beautiful rose garden, thousands and thousands of roses in it. And the temple was just like, you know, 200-300 meters from this park, from this rose garden. And any time a visiting personality we knew was coming to the temple, you would just send a couple of the Brahmacharinis out, you know, on their japa walk. And, you know, the visiting personalities must have thought, wow, this temple's pretty opulent temple. You know, they were getting like this extraordinary garland of these huge, wonderful roses, you know, beautiful different varieties, etc., etc. But of course, we always justified it as in Krishna's, we're using it in Krishna's service. But here's Lord Chaitanya saying that the revenue of the government is more sacred than the property of a Brahmin. The next one. One who serves the government but misappropriates the government's revenue is liable to be punished by the king. That is the verdict of all revealed scriptures. So those three quotes were all stated by Lord Chaitanya when the devotees came to plead on behalf of Gopinath Patanayaka. Anyway, as the story goes, in the ultimate issue, the king himself, when he finds out about the story, he absolves Gopinath Patanayaka of any wrongdoing and he releases him from being on the Changha like that. And actually, it's also interesting, going back to the thing I said at the beginning of the class, that as individual devotees, we shouldn't be seeking any material benefit from our service. But as an organization, and particularly the leaders in the organization, but kind of all everyone in the organization, we should be concerned about the welfare of devotees, that they have a nice place to sleep, they've got nice prasadam, their health is okay, all of that. So that kind of scenario. So the king, what he did, he didn't only released Gopinath from the Changa, he doubled his salary. He doubled his salary. And the logic of doubling his salary was to reduce any possibility of temptation of, you know, taking the government's money like that. So it's kind of interesting, again, from ISKCON's point of view, you know, if you find that some of your brahmacharis or brahmacharinis or whatever it may be are sneaking in and stealing the Mahaprasadam, then maybe, you know, you should make sure that they have a bigger plate of prasadam during prasadam time. But that was the king's response. He doubled his salary. Now, when Gopinath was freed from this situation and the threat of him being suffering the changa was over, there's two more quotes, short quotes, that I'll just read. And this was Lord Chaitanya's advice, if you like, to Gopinath Patanayaka. He says, Lord Chaitanya says, just obey one order from me. Do not spend any of the king's revenue. And the second one, most important one, I think, in that sense for us as devotees and in relation to today's verse, don't spend a farthing for sinful activities, or you will be the loser in this life and the next. And in that same pastime, Kashi Mishra makes the same point, that we're fool number one to use any benefit from devotional service for our own sense gratification. We're fool number one. So Lord Chaitanya is just underlining that. Don't spend a farthing for sinful activities, or you will be the loser in this life and the next. So I just thought that tied in nicely with today's verse and the principle of devotional service and the fact that we are convinced philosophically, we're convinced logically, and that's why we're all sitting here, that's why we all chant Hare Krishna, that's all why we engage in devotional service. We're convinced it's a thing that we should do, that we should really, really guard against spoiling it by wanting some material benefit as a result of the service that we perform. Thank you all very much. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki. Yes, Prabhu. It's just I'm looking at time, but yes, Prabhu, please. No, no, please, please. Go ahead, Prabhu. No, please, please go. Please, Prabhu. I'd love to hear what you have to ask. To try to answer your question in terms of specifically where does the benediction come from, I don't know that I'm qualified to answer that specific question, where does the actual benediction come from. But what did cross my mind when you were speaking was that, and of course we know Prabhupada, his message was uncompromising, and ultimately the uncompromising message is the thing that's best for us, but I just wrote in that, you know, every year I have to write a letter or two for the Janmashtami magazines that they produce in the UK, you know, the Manor and different temples. And I actually wrote exactly what you're talking about. Because, you know that the audience,
a large part of that audience are not practicing devotional service in the same mood that devotees of ISKCON are practicing it. A lot of them are kind of Indian congregational members. And I actually wrote in my thing that, you know, if you perform fasting on the day of Janmashtami, you know, you get this benefit, because that's stating in Shastra that you get this benefit. So, you know, even in my own letter, I'm kind of encouraging the very thing that I'm discouraging based on this verse today, like that. But, you know, Prabhupada gives that example, doesn't he, that you know, doing things like that, they're obviously beneficial, but people are seeing it that in that way that it's described in that verse. And Prabhupada gives the example then for devotees that it's a little bit like, he talks about Kartik, Prabhupada, and he says that it's Kartik, the month of Kartik, and he talks about, you know, if you go to a shop and it has a sale on, the January sales or whatever it may be, Christmas, whatever, and they've got the sale on, probably makes the connection between that and the month of Kartik, and that you can go to Vrindavan and, you know, your service is multiplied, or the benefit, again using that word, of your service is multiplied 1,000 times during the month of Kartik. But probably makes the point that that's of no relevance to a devotee, because they're engaged in devotional service the whole time. It actually has no relevance to them. So I suppose, because actually in the translation it's worth noting that the last sentence says, indeed he is no better than the merchant who wants profit exchange for this. Sorry, not in the translation, in the purport. Prabhupada says, in the Patram Pushpam Phalam Toyam part, he says, thus a man with a mercantile mentality thinks that if he can get some material benefit, like a large amount of money, simply by offering a little fruit and flour, this is good business. Such persons are not accepted as pure devotees. So obviously they're still accepted as devotees on a certain level, and as you pointed out, there's all different stages in that process. So the message for me would be that there's nothing inherently wrong with people even looking for some kind of material benefit from service. There's nothing sinister or evil about it, but you have to be managing it in a way that you're going in the right direction, because as I said at the beginning of the class, if you're going in the wrong direction, ultimately you can end up like Aranyakashipu. So we can't be artificial, because that's the other thing, isn't it? If we're artificial about it, how many of you had this experience that on a normal day, it's not a fast day, it's nothing, perfectly normal day, and you're going to take breakfast, and you bump into a devotee, and you say to them, oh, I'm just going to take breakfast, do you want to come and take prasadam with me? And they say, oh, I don't take breakfast. And when I hear that, I think to myself, I think of two things. I think, one, gosh, I'm such a rascal, you know, I'd never even dream of thinking of not taking breakfast on a normal day. You know, it's like, come on, it's tough enough not taking breakfast on days you don't have to take it without having to not take it on days when you can take it. But then I think to myself, but hey, you know, that's okay, because if I try to do that and it's above my ability, I just get frustrated, you know, and I'll get, next thing I'll be shouting at a devotee at 11 o'clock because I'm hungry, you know, and I'm getting on someone's case and they don't deserve it, etc. And then I think of pastimes. I'm sorry, I'm kind of rambling now, but I think of pastimes. Actually, Lakshmi Moni was here, she's left. But there's a pastime involving Lakshmi Moni where she's cooking. It's the first time she's ever cooking for Prabhupada. She's been cooking for a few days. And the next day is Lord Nityananda's appearance day. So she goes, I think, to Tamal Krishna Maharaj the night before, and she asks Tamal Krishna Maharaj, what should I do for Prabhupada tomorrow for his breakfast? He says, no, you don't do breakfast tomorrow. It's a fast day, you know, Lord Nityananda's appearance day. So next day comes, Prabhupada gives class, etc., etc. And about 8:30, 8:45, the bell rings for Lakshmi Moni. So Lakshmi Moni goes into Prabhupada's room, pays her obeisances, gets up, and Prabhupada says, breakfast is ready? And Lakshmi Moni, you know, she's like, oh, you know. And she says, no, Prabhupada, it's Lord Nityananda's appearance day. And Prabhupada looks up at her and says, yes, I know. I said, yeah, as if Prabhupada wouldn't be aware that it's his appearance day. So she says, I asked the devotees, I asked Tamal Krishna Maharaj last night, you know, because normally it's a fast day, and what should I cook? And he said that I shouldn't cook, so I haven't cooked any breakfast. And Prabhupada slaps his desk, you know, and he says, milk and fruits are also fasting. So the artificial renunciation, you know, trying to do more than our sort of psychophysical nature allows us to do. That can be counterproductive. So I think, you know, accepting benefit, and if you want some benefit, some recognition sometimes, you know, it's hard for us, you know. If you've done some wonderful translation of some book or something like that, and you're in some gathering, and someone's giving somebody else the credit. Well, it's like the story I told about the devotee who didn't leave the fan on, but Prabhupada sort of accused of leaving the fan on. You know, if we just think, oh, mercy, 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 but we're not on that level of realization, it can be counterproductive. So I suppose my answer would be that it's okay, as long as we're progressing in the right direction and becoming more renounced as opposed to. Oh, fantastic. Wow. Fantastic. Simony. Ah, that's right. Yeah. Fantastic. Basimony. The making of profit out of sacred things. So we should be very careful. I mean, we have to finish now, but that goes into a whole discussion about even what's happening now in our world headquarters in terms of, you know, land and development. It's a very, very to be continued, yes. Hare Krishna, Srila Prabhupada ki. Thank you, Prabhupada. Simon.